All right, welcome everyone. I'm Angela Haas. I'll be the chair for this panel, Religious Minorities in the French Revolution, Tolerance, Violence, and Emancipation. Our first speaker is Brian Banks. He is Assistant Professor of History at SUNY Adirondack. He's currently working on a monograph titled The First Refugees, Huguenot in the Age of Enlightenment. He is also editor of the website ageofrevolutions.com and a soon-to-be-published edited collection entitled Freedom and Faith, the French Revolution and Religion in Global Perspective with Palgrave. His paper is titled Subtle Protests, Rethinking the Edict of Toleration's Reception in Calvinist France.
Thank you, Angela. Good morning, everybody. Okay. Thank you for coming out to an 8 a.m. panel. It's very early, and I imagine the breakfast crowd will still be making their way in here shortly, but thank you nonetheless. So this paper was sparked in part by an email Ian sent back to me in August asking about the Edict of Toleration and its reception amongst the Calvinist community and how historians have conceived of 1787 as it relates to the politics of religion during the French Revolutionary period. So in many ways, my paper is guided by two goals. One, to try to conceptualize how we think about Louis XVI's so-called Edict of Toleration, and also to try to think about, or at least a little more critically, about how Calvinists respond to a document that's often seen in purely celebratory terms. And part of this of the conceptual work I think needed on the Edict of Toleration is narratological. At least from the Calvinist perspective, the Edict of Toleration has been a kind of convenient denouement, a concluding point for historians of the 18th century trying to grapple with a complicated comedy. That is a story that ends really, or starts really poorly and ends really well, right? In 1685, the revocation of the Edict of Nantes effectively outlaws Calvinism in the country, expels 200,000 Huguenots out into the wider diaspora, starts a period of state-sponsored persecution, will send the Calvinists into a period they call their désert, which is supposed to have this kind of heavy-handed biblical connotation to it, as well as to emphasize the kind of peripheral, rural, clandestine spaces that they occupy in their worship. And this comedy, I think, we can find in the titles of a lot of books over the course of the 18th century. Just to give two examples of texts here, Jeffrey Adams's classic 1991, The Huguenots and French Opinion, begins in 1685, ends in 1787. Peter Salins's article 3 years later, Fictions of a Catholic France, The Naturalization of Foreigners, begins in 1685, ends in 1787. And this is just to name a few, but that periodization, the désert, really becomes ingrained in the Calvinist conscience, especially in the 19th century. With the exception, perhaps, of David Garrick's recent book, The Huguenots of Paris and the Coming of Religious Freedom, 1685 and this time to 1789, most historical works on the Calvinist community tend to obscure the period between 1787 and the revolutionary outbreak. Yet even in Garrick's book, the coming of religious freedom, as we see in the title, seems almost inevitable, whereas I'm going to argue for Calvinists in the 18th century, toleration and its pursuits were anything but inevitable. By focusing on the Calvinist reception of the Edict of Toleration, it's possible to see just how uncertain religious toleration remained even after Louis XVI's edict in 1787. And as I argue in this paper, Calvinists reacted to the edict in a variety of ways, ranging from the celebratory to the critical. Then, therefore, by refocusing our historical gaze, not necessarily from the revocation to 1787 and trying to think of 1787 moving forward, we might be tempted to adopt a rather more piecemeal narrative, a kind of pseudo-Tocquevillian narrative of a revolution that affected by convulsive and sudden effort what would have occurred gradually as affected by time had it never occurred. In terms of the toleration of the Calvinist community in France, the Edict of Toleration might lead us to the 10th article of the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen that protected opinion even in religion. Or maybe we continue on to the Christmas Eve legislation of 1789, which sought to institutionalize the freedom of religion of the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen, at least for the Calvinists. But the question concerning legal restrictions against these Calvinists and could continue on well into the revolutionary period. I remember a number of years ago I was going through the Archive Parlementaire looking for any and every example of Calvinist politics. And even into 1790, 91, 92, 93, they pop up time and time again. Should a Calvinist be able to hold this public office or have this profession or so on and so forth? And in 1790, all the way to 1799, there's this debate that lingers on about whether or not property should be returned to Huguenots who were forced out of the country at the end of the 17th century. So these debates continue, nonetheless, to the Napoleonic period, through the Concordat, the Organic Articles, and on into the future. And I think by conceiving of the Edict of Toleration as then not necessarily a grand moment of liberation for the Calvinists, but rather as a kind of revocation of restrictions, this encourages us to identify those voices who subtly and overtly resisted Catholic monarchical power and adopted new discourses to pursue further protections, privileges, and liberties. The need to adopt new discourses of religious liberty emerged, I think, then as a response to the rather limited language of and concessions of the edict itself. So before we go any further, I think it's necessary to actually talk about what the edict purported to do, what civic rights it would have guaranteed in 1787. The language of the edict was purposefully ambiguous. Protestants were the principal minority in question, but Louis XVI and his ministers chose to use the phrase non-Catholics throughout the document. Ambiguity in the Edict of Toleration reaffirmed Catholic dominance in the kingdom and reflected the longer trend of denying the Protestant faith's legitimacy, most obviously imbued, I think, in the phrase RPR, religion prétendue réformée, right? The justification of all of this is in the preamble, and I'm going to read this at length because it's just so shocking to me every single time. But while waiting for divine providence to bless our efforts and effect this happy revolution, by which they mean the conversion of all non-Catholics to Catholicism, justice and the interest of our kingdom do not permit us to exclude any longer from the rights of civil status those of our subjects or resident foreigners in our empire who do not profess the Catholic religion. A rather long experience has shown that harsh ordeals are insufficient to convert them. We should therefore no longer suffer that our laws punish them unnecessarily for the misfortune of their birth by depriving them of the rights that nature constantly claims for them. The first article to follow guarantees the Catholic, Apostolic, and Roman religion will continue to enjoy alone in our kingdom the right to public worship. From there, the king grants non-Catholics the rights to register their births, marriages, and deaths, to be tracked by the state, or for the state to guarantee certain civic rights for the Protestant families. 37 articles in total detail the exact parameters of these civil ceremonies, but continue to limit the presence of minority cults in the public sphere. Louis XVI's edict should ultimately be understood then as a revocation of restrictions, rather than as this emancipatory document. In this paper, I want to also resist the urge to mirror Louis XVI's effacement of the Calvinist community. And as such, I think we need to reconsider the agency of the benighted French Calvinists, who in the historiography of the French 18th century often become bystanders in their own march towards toleration. And I think this is the case for three prominent reasons. First, I think 18th century narratives of the march towards religious toleration in part are due to the triumphalist interpretations of Enlightenment modernity. Right? We think of Voltaire coming to the aid of the Calas family. We think of the epic treatise on tolerance. And at least for my students, they always seem to draw a line from that point to the outbreak of the revolution and so-called religious freedom. The second reason reflects the social and legal conditions of Calvinists in France during the Désert period, when Calvinists were a nation within a nation, banned from public positions in many professions. They were forced to practice their faith illegally and clandestinely. And lastly, I think the relegated role of the Calvinist communities in this narrative also reflects rather facile readings of the praise lavished upon Louis XVI for his edict by French Calvinists and Catholics alike. And now, outwardly, Calvinists did praise, right, at least publicly in their pastoral sermons, they praised the Edict of Toleration. And I think the retroactively constructed mystique around the Edict of Toleration, which, again, gives very little, it would seem, and often in a condescending tone, is embedded in the historiography in the 19th century, it also owes to these French Calvinist panegyrics following 1787. So just to give us some examples of these here, in Languedoc, a surviving hymn praised Louis XVI as a great liberator. The pane reads, "Louis returned our rights. He is the most just of kings, like the most cherished of fathers after the storm. He is gentle. The dawn of a more prosperous day comes." I think the dawn of a more prosperous day is written in this kind of hopeful and this kind of futuristic language is important to emphasize here, because we find that same language then mirrored in other pastoral statements following 1787. A pastor from Saint-Foy remarked that, quote, "In the future, one can be French without being Catholic. The conscience is independent from the magistrate and all matters that do not consider public order." And again, I think if we juxtapose the claims that these Protestants are making next to the actual Edict of Toleration, it all seems quite curious. And you're left to wonder if these Protestants never read the document at all, if they just misinterpreted it, are they misleading their congregation, right? All these kinds of questions flurry about. And on a level, this is conjecture, because nowhere in the records did the pastors then, you know, step to the side and say to a friend, you know, I'm tricking them all because I want them to be hopeful and I want them to continue to come to my sermons and so on and so forth. But again, I think we should be calling into question this praise, because this discourse is disconnected from reality in many ways in the kingdom. To give an example from Yves Krumenacher's work, poor Protestants in Lyon, in a city with a very long history of religious intolerance, refused to register in most cases in the following year after 1787. Up until the outbreak of the revolution, over 1,000 Protestant families, Krumenacher says, in a given area. Out of all of those, only 65 certificates of birth, marriage, and deaths were actually presented to the city in the next year and a half or so. Now, you know, whether that's just people don't like bureaucracy, or they're trying to resist something, or they don't quite trust Louis XVI. Again, that's a bit up for conjecture here. Okay, but in part, I think this has to do with conceptions of 18th century law too. I think that the law is often considered very fluid. Its ability to shift with the whims of the king seems to be evidenced, at least to some, by the superficial concessions of the edict itself. And for that reason, it's not registered in a number of parliaments around the kingdom. Perhaps this disconnect between Calvinist discourse and social reaction explains the rather lackluster presence of Calvinist politics in the Cahiers de Doléances as well. In his classic study on the Reformed Church in the 18th century, Burdett Poland concluded that the typical attitude of the Calvinists in France was one of indifference to the Edict of Toleration. A fraction addressed the Calvinist question at all of these cahiers, about a third of the ones that he examined, and at least 13 of the cahiers expressed satisfaction with the Edict of Toleration, but insisted that the Estates General formally approve of the edict, quote, in order that the liberty of citizens never again be compromised by a revocation of the law, close quote. Again, that emphasis on the fluidity here. The reluctance of French Calvinists towards the Edict of Toleration hinged on their general distrust of the law, the precarity of which only seemed further reified by these specious claims to a spiritual revolution that Calvinists would eventually effect to the Catholic Church. But arguably the most famous Protestant pastor and later president of the National Assembly, Rabbi Saint-Étienne, was the most outspoken opponent of the Edict of Toleration. For Saint-Étienne, there were two issues which plagued Calvinists in post-1787 France: ignorance and limited tolerance. The first related to the general misunderstanding driven by the hyperbolic response it received of the edict. In this 1789 speech on behalf of religious freedom in front of the nascent National Assembly, Saint-Étienne clarifies immediately, "The only thing that non-Catholics gained in the edict of November 1787, and some of you gentlemen may not be aware of this, was what could not be refused them." Yes, what could not be refused them. I do not repeat this without shame, but it is not an empty accusation. These are the edict's own words. The edict, more famous than fair, Saint-Étienne says, opened avenues for Calvinists to record their births, marriages, and deaths, and that's all it does. With a base knowledge of the edict established, Saint-Étienne could then address what the law did to his mind and its inherent limitations. Tolerance, he exclaims. I demand that the very word be banished, and it will be this unfair word which presents us only as citizens deserving of pity, as criminals to be pardoned. the distinctions of Catholic and non-Catholic used in the edict divided France into, quote, two castes, one favored and one excluded, close quote. For Saint-Étienne, his abandonment of toleration for religious liberty reflected the universalist rhetoric at the outset of the revolution. Tolerance implied a patriarchal authority, Catholicism and the Catholic state, benignly tolerating a religion that once went by the pseudo-official designation of RPR, and in 1787, again, was effaced into this homogeneous non-Catholic group. Saint-Étienne had worked among the cohort of French lawyers and statesmen who had pushed for the edict in 1787. Having left his congregation in Nîmes for Paris in the early 1780s, Saint-Étienne joined the cohort composed of the historian Roubier, the Marquis de Lafayette, Malherbe, and others. From 1785 to 1787, they published tracts promoting legal toleration. While the civic register of births, marriages, and deaths were at the forefront, the issue of public worship remained the most important aim for Saint-Étienne. As a pastor, this shouldn't be surprising, I think. In his 1779 Triomphe de l'Intolérance, later retitled Le Vœu Savonnel, Saint-Étienne made a sentimental argument on behalf of Protestant religious liberty, the crux of which for him was the natural right of public worship, a principle common to all faiths in the world. After reviewing the final draft of the edict on November 16, 1787, Saint-Étienne commented that the issue of public worship and the ability for pastors to speak on behalf of the Calvinist community would only continue to deny the Calvinists their natural rights. In 1789, then, when Rabbi Saint-Étienne addressed the assembly in favor of a more explicit guarantee of religious freedom in the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen, he pleaded for public worship again, almost as an afterthought. I like to think that he realized he was losing the people in front of him when he says, he comes back to the podium, he goes, a free cult for which I'm asking you is a common cult. All cults are necessarily cults of many. A cult composing of one person is simple adoration, it is prayer. But none of you can ignore that no religion has ever existed without common worship. Christians cannot deny Christians of communal worship without violating their own principles, since all believe in the necessity of public worship. The idea of a public common worship is a dogma, an article of faith. It is therefore a religious opinion in all justice of the expression. The wording officially adopted here in the 1789 Declaration did not explicitly guarantee freedom of public worship. It states, quote, no one should be disturbed for his opinions, even in religion, provided that their manifestation does not trouble public order as established by law. Yet Saint-Étienne, a leader of the Calvinist community, continued to push for public exercises of faith in the years to come before he met his untimely end. So what I'd like to do last then is just offer some concluding remarks concerning the Edict of Toleration and these myriad responses that Calvinists have to the Edict. In reaction to the Edict, Calvinists respond in a number of ways. Rabbi Saint-Étienne was the most vocally opposed and also occupied an elite position from which to make his voice heard. But other pastors in the provinces, through their own volition based on hope or misinterpretation, praised Louis XVI's Edict. Yet I think this politics of praise needs to be understood as a rhetorical device, equally pandering, perhaps, and hopeful, as it was critical, as at least capable of being a form of subtle protest. Thinking beyond the mere replication of misinterpretation, it is possible that Calvinist pastors insisted on the grandeur and emancipatory character of the edict because they feared a kind of religious tokenism. The king and Catholics could lean on the edict and its institutionalized limited tolerance as a justification to continue to restrict the Calvinist community from public sphere or as a vehicle to return to the legal intolerance of the pre-1787 period. Early revolutionary rhetoric against religious freedoms proved these fears valid, albeit for the Jewish population. On December 22, 1789, Abbé Maury opposed granting French Jews further rights because rights had already been extended to Protestants. Presented as almost an afterthought following his rebuke of Jewish inclusion, Maury held that, quote, Protestants have the same religion and the same laws as us Catholics as established by the Edict of Toleration, but they, French Jews, are a different cult. And I think Maury here is responding to efforts to cascade, to borrow Lynn Hunt's words here, right, or word, rights to religious minorities. During the Revolution, the French Jewish community, as I'm sure we'll learn more from Ron here in a second, sought to revoke restrictions against them as well in 1790. On January 28, 1790, several deputies delivered a petition to the National Assembly that utilized Protestantism's nascent citizenship to bolster their case for Jewish inclusion. They say this, quote, "For a long time, they, the king and the Catholic Church, confronted the Protestants with this maxim, worthy of the Inquisition, and the Protestants had no civil standing in France. Today, they have just been reestablished in the possession of this status. They are assimilated to the Catholics in everything. The intolerant maxim that we have just retraced can no longer be used against them. Why would they continue to use it, it as an argument against the Jews?" So tokenism and cascading rights discourses surrounded the Edict of Toleration in the early phase of the French Revolution. Calvinists feared that Louis XVI would revoke his limited tolerance or that the French Revolution would never grant freedom of public worship. In this way, from the Calvinist perspective, the Edict of Tolerance and the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen shared similar limitations, perhaps. Catholic or secular authority could continue to limit the public worship of Calvinists. The political need of public safety, guarded by sole claim to the public sphere by the Catholic Church or the secular political state, could both lead to a kind of top-down political privatization of religion process, or at least one which kept Calvinists in the dark of their desert clandestine setting. The discourse of religious freedom developed and took the Edict of Toleration as a benchmark in their political narratives, as a praiseworthy step towards liberation or as a last breath of intolerance. But on the ground, the Calvinist community remained trapped between their hopes for religious freedom and their fears of returning to the revocation period, arguably something that continues well through the Terror, through the Napoleonic period, and the White Fear, and all the way through the 19th century. Thank you.